Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turn It A Punk Classics, a show where we take old episodes of Turn It A Punk that have been lost from the internet and return them to their previous glory by sticking them back on the feed. You can find this podcast on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and all other forms of social media. Well, that's pretty much it. At Turn It A Punk, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Left For Damien. I play in a band. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy another TOAP classic. Chris, thank you so much for doing this. As I told you in message form that I've wanted to do this since I was like 15 years old. So this is a huge thrill to finally get to talk to you.
Thanks, Damien. I really appreciate you taking the time to have any interest in a bunch of old guys.
Oh, please. No, not even. We'll get into, you know, as I don't know if you've heard any of these before, but I always find a way to really shoehorn my way into everyone else's life story.
Yes.
Which is something that I will undoubtedly wind up doing on this one as well. But before I do that, I guess I have to start it off by letting you start it off, which is, how did you get into punk?
The short, simple answer is Millions of Dead Cops.
Do you remember your first, was that the first band you heard that you would describe as kind of punk rock or?
No, I had heard punk bands before that, but I hadn't heard Millions of Dead Cops.
Okay.
And I was a metalhead.
Yeah.
And I grew up in the military, and I was a reactionary right-wing freak about, you know, 13 or 14 years old. You know, I was pro nuclear proliferation. I was pro Reagan. And our drummer, Jord, who was my childhood friend, kind of followed me on my metal journey, and then he started to veer off and was more interested in these punk bands. I didn't really pay attention at first, and he invited me over to check out this record he got, and it was a Millions of Dead Cops record. And he put it on, and I was looking at the back of the record, you know, reading the titles, John Wayne was a Nazi, and listening to the lyrics, and I just thought, this is fucking bullshit. What is this fucking freak music you're listening to, man? And I said, I'm not interested in this. Then I left and immediately went to the record store and bought the record and just sat there with it, because something about it really, I mean, that record to this day, it comes on and it's a special moment in time, never to be recaptured again. And it transformed me. Like, I held up their view of the world to my view of the world, and theirs was reality based, mine was a fucking fantasy. And that was just the gateway into a whole new world of ideas and music. That record was the cause of all this.
So what were the metal bands you were listening to prior to it, like, that were kind of speaking to kind of that more, I guess, right of center worldview, shall we say?
Well, most of the bands, actually, in retrospect, you know, Venom, Raven, early Metallica, like all the early 80s power metal, speed metal as it existed back then,
yeah,
you know, the old style black metal, none of them really spoke to that. They actually were all confronting power and challenging illegitimate authority in their own special ways. But because it wasn't like the lyrics, it wasn't MDC. It wasn't MDC jumped out of the fucking speakers. Dave Dichter grabbed you by the throat and just fucking hammered you over the head with these, what I thought were crazy ideas about the world that all turned out to be true.
Yeah.
And then I was able to actually look back on those records and see, you know, see the elements on a Raven record that were anti-war. Because, I mean, it's a popular, I hope a misconception, but a popular conception that a lot of metal bands lean more to the right, but it's not always true. And if you really dig into a lot of lyrics, they all come from the same place that the punk bands do. It's just the punk bands were more direct. I think Ian MacKaye has talked about this when he started Minor Threat. He wanted to just talk very directly and very simply to people. And it was a real different way of hearing a message, to be hammered over the head with something.
Yeah.
So that really appealed to me at that point in my life, you know, as I was transforming from this little fucking potential military weirdo into a different kind of weirdo.
Why did you think that record got to that record store? Like it's a smaller town, right?
Well, I think George ordered that one, probably from, what was that label it was on?
Our Radical. Yeah.
I think he probably mail ordered that back then. And then I probably went into Winnipeg to Fantastic Records or Records on Wheels and, grabbed it.
You know? For that metal stuff, you had to go into Winnipeg at this point.
Anyway. Well, no, here's another crazy story. Portage La Prairie, the small town we lived in, had a sewing shop called Busy Fingers that people don't believe this, but it was a sewing shop and they sold speed metal. It was crazy. It was crazy. And the owner, who later was charged with some unsavory charges.
Yeah.
In regards to kids, gave me a key to the record racks because I spent so much time there. And luckily I didn't get in any sort of other trouble there, but I got all my speed metal there in this fucking crazy little sewing shop in Portage La Prairie. It was very strange, but they had everything. They had all the Bonsai stuff, all the Cobra stuff, all the Mega Force stuff, imports. It was amazing.
Bizarre.
It was a better selection than Records on Wheels had at the time in Winnipeg.
Wow. So was he into that kind of stuff musically, I guess, or?
No, the guy was like, I mean, I'm sure you remember the episode of Different Strokes. where the guy who owns the bike shop.
Yeah.
He looked like that guy.
Wow.
And yeah, it was fucked up.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Yeah. No, none taken. So where do you think that came from? Was he just trying to get a certain type of youth? Not that you should speculate on this sort of stuff too, but like, it's just such a weird genre to gravitate towards.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he misordered something.
Yeah.
And we wandered in and we're like, whoa, what the fuck? Iron Angel, where the hell did you get this? And then he just started ordering. Yeah. He came in every week.
Yeah, of
course.
To
buy records. And so, yeah.
So I guess, but you went in to get the MDC record at this point. And so was it immediately that you kind of felt everything change for you right after that record? Or was it sort of a slower process?
It's probably slower than I remember,
but yeah.
I remember like I bought it with a strange feeling of hostility, but knowing deep down that, the band, the message, the urgency to the record, spoke to something that was possibly true about what the guy was saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had never heard, I mean, I had heard a lot of urgent raw metal prior to that, but that record, the urgency in that record was something special. And I to this day, I think it's probably one of the top five most urgent sounding records that exists. Mm-hmm. At least in the genre. But yeah, something really resonated with me, and it still does today with that record. What a crazy record to come out back then.
Oh, amazing, you know? Record. It's funny too when you hear about Dave Dichter talk about how all the cops that come up to him to get their photos taken with him. and stuff like that. I've read in interviews where he's like, hey, cops are always asking for photos with me.
It's hilarious.
I know. I'm like, wow, that's very bizarre. And stuff like that. I've had cops come up to me at fucked up shows too, like, hey, that song Police. And then they'll hand me a card, like, twice this has happened, a Police Benevolence Association card. And they're like, if you ever get pulled over, just hand this over with your license.
Really?
So, yeah.
I need one of those.
I know. And they only last for 1 year. And unfortunately, I guess we're not as popular with cops anymore because it's been quite a few years since any cops have handed me any of those.
That's a real thing? Is that just...
I swear to God, yeah, it's
Toronto?
A real...
Where is that?
Yeah, no, I know. This was in New Jersey. Oh, one time it was in New Jersey and one time in Pennsylvania. No, I don't... Trust me, cops in Toronto, we do not have the same relationship. Historically, nowhere near as friendly.
I'd like to get one of those cards for the border.
Yeah, so would I. Oh, my gosh. Like, I just went through that. We just crossed 2 weeks ago to go across. And, you do all the checks before you go there. Like, okay... You know, what do I have here that's going to draw attention to me? And, of course, the book I end up bringing down there to read is Cannabis as Soma, A History of Cannabis in Religion.
Wow. Yeah, that'll do it.
I was juggling that book the entire time we were pulled in for interrogation. Just like, don't let them see the spine. Don't let them see the cover. Don't let them see the spine. Don't let them see the cover. If any border guards are listening to this, that never happened.
Yeah.
So, where did you go from there? Like from MDC? Or I guess at this point you and George's paths are kind of like aligned.
Yeah, we were aligned before, but George was always, he was always testing new waters. And I was just straight up, you know, speed and thrash metal. Don't fucking veer from that path. That's the best. I thought a lot of the, you know, at the time I thought a lot of the punk bands I had heard at that point, like Ramones or whatever, it was too jangly and not, probably just not, there wasn't enough rage prior to that. But then we started to get into, I started to hear some of the bands sort of was listening to, and there was a little more crossover, Crumbsuckers, COC, DRI, obviously, all that stuff was, you know, pre true crossover when things kind of got a little murky there.
Yeah.
And it was all very exciting. It had all the elements, of, like I say, urgency that the metal bands had, but they had, you were able to sit there with the lyric sheets and kind of sit there and think about things, which, you know, a lot of the metal records I listened to didn't really have that. It was almost, you know, fantasy world kind of stuff. Again, in retrospect, they had some, you know, there's some songs about resisting power and stuff like that, but a lot of it was just about death and Satan, which I love also.
Yeah.
But this was just a new thing. Mm-hmm. It felt different when you, at that age, when you feel like you have a new idea, it's a exciting feeling.
Absolutely. So were you into the Cro-Mags at all at this point? Cause I know ultimately you guys cover them and
I
guess.
No, Jordan got, he was like fucking ground level with Age of Quarrel.
Yeah.
And, I thought it was really cool. I probably didn't buy it until a couple of years later.
Yeah.
But he had it right there and we'd listen to it. And, I knew that was a special record too, but there was something dull about, I think it was the recording quality, actually, now that I think about it, that I'm saying this out loud.
That's why they always say the demo is the way better version, right?
Yeah. You know, I almost like the record better. I have the demos too, but I can hear why people would say that because they are more in your face. But yeah, Cro-Mags, my God.
Did you go to that show in Winnipeg? Because they that famous bootleg from a Winnipeg show.
No, I moved into Winnipeg the day they were playing with GBH and Corpus Vile at the Rendezvous the day I moved into the city. They played Wellington's, I think, the night before.
Yeah.
That's that bootleg at Wellington's.
Yeah.
And I moved into the city, got on the bus, went downtown, got off the bus, saw a poster on a telephone pole or something, said GBH, Cro-Mags, Corpus Vile, at the Rendezvous. And I was 15 years old thinking, I don't know where I am. I don't know where this is. I didn't even know if I was allowed to take the poster off the pole. I was a fucking country bumpkin, and there's no way my mom was going to let me go to that. I mean, previously, two years before that in Portage, I was crying because my mom wouldn't take me into Winnipeg to see Venom and Slayer. And I knew she wasn't going to let me go see fucking bunch of skinheads from New York City going mental at the Rendezvous. So no, I wish I, that would have been amazing, but I did not go to that. I had friends who were at it, and there's mixed reviews about, you know, the real life version of it.
Yeah, of course.
It wasn't quite as exciting as the, yeah.
What were your first shows? Like, what shows were you, were there shows going on before you moved into Winnipeg that you were going to, or?
Yeah, we went to Stretch Marks. I think that was probably our first, the first show me and Jord went to.
Awesome.
For real. We were from Portage. We were wearing hockey jackets. We thought we looked older. We went to Wellington's. They had an RCMP officer at the door to make sure kids didn't get in. He went to the can, and the skinhead working the door let us in and told us to go sit in the corner. And we went and sat in the corner for 6 hours. We saw Followers and Slaves, Silent Asylum and Stretch Marks. And it was a crazy situation, because it was also a bar in downtown Winnipeg, and we were kids from Portage. So, but it was a point where, I mean, Stretch Marks, they were like a Western Canadian prairie punk band, and that was even, had less of the hallmarks of metal and hardcore than the punk bands from other places. You know, there was a real distinct Western Canadian punk sound, I think.
Well, I think it's also, I don't know if you're talking about the same thing, but it's almost like that kind of drum beat that, mm-hmm. I would say it proliferates all over Canada around that time. That almost,
yeah,
like a rock thing.
Yeah. Like almost like an SSD record, except not as heavy, drum wise. It was more like rock and roll, and I liked it, and it was exciting to see it live, but, it wasn't what I wanted.
It wasn't MDC.
No, to be honest, when people talk about the old Winnipeg punk and hardcore scenes, everybody venerates the early 80s, mm-hmm. you know, as the golden age. For me, the golden age was about 86 to 88, early 89, when you had bands like Artificial Life, Global Genocide, Crown of Thorns, Corpus Vile, DAC. That, to me, that was the best, because that was when the punk bands got faster, got heavier. Just, it was a little more youthful sounding at that point.
Yeah, I love that Personality Crisis record and stuff, and the Low Life 7-inch and all that stuff. But you're right,
that stuff
is where you can hear like it starts coalescing a little bit more and becoming a little heavier.
Yeah, I mean, Lance from Low Life went on to Crown of Thorns, who were from 86 to 88, or 89 even, were the shit in Winnipeg. They were it seemed like they were going to be like Metallica at the time.
Did they put out a record?
No, they didn't. They only did a demo.
Okay, because I know Dangerously American.
Corpus Vile.
Sorry.
No, go ahead. Yeah, DAC had a 7-inch. Artificial Life had a 7-inch.
Yeah.
Corpus Vile actually put out a record on Fringe.
Yeah, of course. I got a test press of that recently at a record
Me
store.
Me too.
Oh.
Yeah. I actually have the original mix before they got signed to Fringe. It's a different mix.
Really?
And I've written Brian Taylor a few times over the years trying to get the master tapes, which every time he tells me that they don't exist anymore, but I keep persisting for some reason. That and Guilt Parade. I try to find out who has the master tapes for those records.
Oh, yeah.
But Corpus Vile were the only one of those bands to put out a full LP. But the DAC 7-inch and the Artificial Life 7-inches are amazing. The Beach Mutant 7-inch is amazing.
Oh, fantastic. I love that 7-inch.
Yeah. If you can ever find a copy of the Global Genocide Facts of War cassette, that's the only thing they ever put out. It's fucking unreal. That was my golden era for Winnipeg.
So that's your scene, right? Like those are the bands that you kind of like come up in, like going to see, I guess.
Going to see, but this is before I was in a band.
Yeah, no, I mean, but like, yeah, this was your scene, I guess, that you were going to these shows.
Yeah.
At what point are you playing? Are you playing already?
Well, me and Jord are playing. you know, we have ideas and we have jammed a few times and we know the, you know, we want to call something propaganda or whatever, but we weren't playing out. We had no friends. We didn't know anybody. You know, it wasn't till 88 or 89 that we actually got somebody to come play bass for us. And that was Scott Hopper, who had been in Global Genocide and Amorphic Disunity. And it wasn't till, I don't think we played our first show till 1990.
Oh, really? So the same year you guys did the first demo?
The first demo was late 88 or early 89. I think.
I'm not calling you on this, but I'm just pulling out my copy right now, Chris, to check.
what's your tape called?
Propaganda. Oh, on the tape itself.
Yeah. Is it they don't get paid? They don't get laid?
Yeah. We don't get paid. We don't get laid. And boy, are we lazy.
And what year does it say?
1990.
Oh fuck! I thought I had more cred than that.
Oh well, hey, I'm not calling you because also today I'd always heard that you guys formed in 1989, and then I read on the internet you guys formed in 1986.
Yeah, but again, it was like me and George in Portage. Hey, we're a band, and then we, you know, we didn't really have any serious songs until '88, you know, when we were both in Winnipeg, and well, I would say that demo you have was probably, well, I thought it was recorded in 89. Maybe it came out and I don't fucking know.
Okay.
I was going to also ask you, there's like, now I got to do that. Oh, sorry. One sec again. It's like, on 10 Tapes O'Connor Records. What's that in reference to?
Oh, 10 Tapes O'Connor. That is, that's hilarious. Wow. That's bringing back some memories. I haven't seen that tape in many, many years, but that's, we used to have nicknames for everybody in the scene. We didn't know anybody, but we had nicknames for everybody. And that was the guy, that was the skinhead that worked at Fantastic Records on Notre Dame.
It's funny that you say that, because like me and my brother, who was the first person that I really kind of started going to shows with, my younger brother and some friends, we all had nicknames for people. You know, it's like weird that you do that. It's, I guess it's a universal punk thing to kind of like.
Well, it's, especially if you're more of an observer in the scene, like you go to the shows and you look around and you see the people doing all this cool stuff and you're like, hey, there's that guy. There's that guy. They never see us. They never talk to us, but that's that guy. We better have a name for him so we know who we're talking about.
If only that skinhead knew his important place in Canadian music history, starting it all off. So, so you guys start, you and George start playing together and, I guess get a band. If I'm jumping and skipping anything important as far as other bands that you wanted to talk about or touch on, please, we can go back and talk about them.
Yeah.
But I guess you guys start playing and start forming a band you know, and I guess 3 years, 4 years later, play a show.
Yes, that is pretty much accurate. In that meantime, like George was in a band, he played in a high school band that played a few punk songs, probably in 87 or 88, called The Ditch Pigs.
Okay.
And then I played in the post-Global Genocide band Crawl.
Okay.
That was the first show I played.
What was that show?
That we played with Gorilla, who's...
Biff Naked.
That's Ken Jameson. Yeah, Biff Naked. That was her band. We played with Gorilla and...
And also Limo's in Gorilla too, for like No Effects.
That's right. He played drums, and it was a wild show, man, to play your first show. Oh, and we played with Immortal Possession, which was Evil Chuck. Kind of a Winnipeg metal legend. They played and it was fucking packed and people were going mental. It was a crazy memory, but then that all faded and we started our own thing.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So you guys started your own thing and you know, it's actually amazing this demo, how realized it is, you know? This is also on the double 7-inch, right? That Recess Records put out eventually.
Oh, probably. I apologize for that too.
It's okay. I bought one version on Recess Records where it's actually both the same 7-inch on different colored vinyls, but I'm stoked.
That doesn't surprise me.
I'd still buy that again. You know, I'm acting like I'm above buying multiple things of the same version. But like, it's crazy. You guys have songs that are like, you know, like pretty pretty like, so those are the types of songs you guys were writing right away? Like, I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is, when did you get politicized? Like so politicized?
Well, when was that? I guess the, how many years from that MDC? I guess it was just, you know, from that MDC record till that moment of making that demo. It was just, and maybe also at the time, the first Bad Religion record we had heard,
mm-hmm.
The Suffer record. And, I guess just in there, just in that short amount of time, we just thought, oh, and Guilt Parade. I mean, Guilt Parade was a huge influence. When we started the band, we thought that's what we were going to do. We were going to be like Guilt Parade.
Really?
Yeah. Like the, we thought that LP was, they were what we looked to when we made all those original songs. We thought, well, yeah, it's, you know, they're funny, but their songs mean something, and they're fucking, they have this metallic edge to it, but they're punk and they're hardcore.
Did they make it out
to do that?
Had you seen them play already by this point, I guess?
Yeah. We had seen them. They came through like 3 or 4 times through Winnipeg, and I went every time. They had a different lineup each time too.
Yeah. Dallas Good from the Sadies was in the last lineup. He was telling me when he was on
show.
Yeah. When he was on the show, he was like, one of his favorite bands too. And he's like, yeah, I played in Guilt Parade in the last lineup.
Oh, no way. I probably saw him play then.
Yeah. I don't know if he might have, yeah, I guess he did do the tour. So yeah, probably.
Huh? Yeah. I loved Guilt Parade. No one really came out to see them when they came here, but, we always made the trip out because they were like, to us, it was like the Canadian Dead Kennedys. We thought we were hoped that there was going to be more from them, but there never was.
Were you vegan by this point, or?
No, I think a vegetarian. I didn't even know what vegan was until the early 90s.
Well, I didn't know what veganism was till Propagandhi, so you have me beat. I guess, which is funny, because, like, I guess I'm fascinated by this, because, like, if you talk to anyone kind of my generation on in punk rock, it's like, when did you become political? It's like, oh, when I heard Propagandhi. So it's always, like, fascinating to hear, you know, where the politicizing force got politicized.
Right. Yeah, well, I guess the credit goes to that MDC record. Obviously, the thoughts weren't fully formed by the time we put out those, well, many of our records, I would say. But we're still a work in progress on that front, I would say.
I think all bands are, but normally it's a it's a regression.
Yeah.
So from that demo, I guess you guys are playing out. What's the first Propagandhi show?
First Propagandhi show was 2 nights at the Royal Albert Arms here in Winnipeg with Grog and Immortal Possession.
Wow, that's pretty crazy for 2 night stand for your first 2 shows.
Yeah, I think Wayne Towns, who the legendary owner of mm-hmm. the Albert, gave us our usual 12 of Labatt's 50 for the 2 nights, and gave us a room to sleep in. I think that nobody in the other bands dared to sleep in.
Did you guys stay?
Yeah. Yeah, it was very exciting back then. It was so exciting.
Yeah,
to be playing at the Albert and staying at the Albert. And it was crazy. It was a crazy time.
What was that night like? Was it a adventure filled night of people knocking on the doors and such, or?
No, it was very quiet, and very uncomfortable.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it was cold and dreary, and I think we wished we were back in our fucking hovel on Beverly Street at the time.
And I guess you guys played with Fugazi pretty early on too, or?
Yeah, that was crazy. That was probably our 3rd or 4th show.
Wow.
We knew a guy who at the time was, you know, putting on shows, and he got us on a Rise show. Remember Rise from, I think they're from Toronto.
Yeah.
Or were they from Montreal?
No, Rise Montreal.
Montreal or Toronto? Yeah, they were, they had an EP that I thought was amazing. Rise, Fugazi was, I mean, that was crazy to play that. What else happened then?
Were you a Fugazi fan? Were like, was that a band for you that was, that?
Well, they were another, band. Well, the first 2 EPs, I was like, wow, this is weird. This is, oh, I like this. This is weird. I can't believe I like this. This isn't metal or hardcore. What's going on here? Why do I like this?
Yeah.
And then I kind of, to be honest, I lost track of Fugazi after those first two EPs. I think it was Margin Walker. And what was the other one?
Waiting Room EP. Is that the?
Yeah, I don't know. Is that what's, yeah, those ones. And then through the 90s, I totally ignored it while everybody was going crazy about it until they put out the Argument LP, which I thought was their crowning achievement. In 2000 and something.
Yeah.
And So I'm familiar with those records in the 90s that they made because everybody fucking played them all the time.
Of course.
But I was sort of a ground floor and then top floor, and I missed all the floors in between.
Mm-hmm.
As far as sitting down with their records goes. So, but they were also a band that I thought I felt a strong respect for. And on some level felt like, you know, they're doing, the way they do things is more interesting than the way people are telling us to do things or that most bands do things. So in that sense, they're very important.
Mm-hmm. So I guess like around this point, or maybe it's a little later on, there's that the weirdest entry in the Propagandhi discography, I think, is that three-way split that came out with Birth Fanzine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. John Bartles, Sockeye, and us.
Yeah. What, like, Propagandhi and Sockeye, never shall the two meet, yet on a split in 1991 they did.
Yeah.
How did that come about? And that's the first record, right?
That's the very first thing we ever did. Yeah. As far as outside of cassettes,
yeah,
on our own. I think it was just songs from one of those cassettes, maybe our second cassette. We knew the guy. What was his name? Chris. Oh yeah. Chris East.
Mm-hmm.
Chris East was his name. He lived in Pennsylvania. He had the zine. I think he was a really wealthy kid.
Was a pretty pro. I remember
he had, yeah. And he would phone me all the time. And he said, he's got this, I don't know if we called them SUVs at the time, but he described this vehicle to us. He's like, yeah, my dad, he gave me a gas card. I didn't know what that was, but it's free gas. In this brand new vehicle to take us on a tour all across America. That never happened. This never happened. But at the time we were like, what the fuck? This guy is fucking hooked up. But he also had the money to make a 7-inch back then. We certainly didn't. We didn't even know how he did it. It was interesting 7-inch. I like the John Bartles song. I remember all those songs. It was a memorable 7-inch for sure.
It's a very memorable 7-inch to say the least. And I think it's also memorable because, well, it's just like so obscure. But number two, it's also memorable because it's also like got like, once again, like a bunch of songs that are kind of like quote unquote classic early Propagandhi songs, including a song that I'm sure has plagued you so much. Like Ska Sucks, which
which one?
Yeah, obviously that's a song, but and I know you've talked about it on your own podcast and things like that, but I thought the hilarious thing about it is that reaction song that Winnipeg Ska band did to it.
Oh yeah.
Hey Chris Cannon, does Ska really suck?
Yeah. I felt more embarrassed for them than I did for me at that point.
Yeah, I did too. I think they performed on Speaker's Corner at one point.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
that song?
I remember watching Speaker's Corner one day, and they're like, hey, we're playing a show tonight at the Horseshoe. It's like a new music Tuesday with Bookie. Come out. And then to the Ska. Hey, Chris Hanna, the Ska really suck.
Oh, boy.
But they didn't go into the Propagandhi breakdown at the end, though, because it was acoustic.
Oh, good.
and I think now history has kind of bore you correct on this one. Like everything you said in that song kind of turned out to be really true. But in the 90s, that was, I imagine.
Oh my God. Yeah. Winnipeg, you did not say that.
No.
We had a bizarre scene that was ruled by skinheads. Skinheads who identified as ska fans and who at the same time were wearing screwdriver shirts and touring around with, you know, white pride shit.
Yeah.
But that is why we wrote it, because the scene was dominated by skinheads and we fucking hated it. Mm-hmm. Fucking hated them. And I remember when a bunch of fucking goofs came through Winnipeg, probably 89 or 90. Just, you know, probably the same year we're starting the band or playing shows. Because the whole scene was cowed, you know, just fucking scared of these skinheads. They would just march into a show, start kicking ass or whatever, inside and out of the shows, which it was kind of exciting looking back. But at the time, it was just pissing us off.
Yeah.
The imbalance of power and a bunch of fucking goofs came to town. And these fucking skinheads tried causing shit at their show. And a bunch of fucking goofs kicked their asses out of the venue. And I was like, fucking rights, man. And then we were like, that's it. We gotta fucking do what we can, you know? And what we, as Pencil Neck Geeks, what we could do was just, mock them.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was misguided. It got under their skin, but that song wasn't meant to be heard by anybody but skinheads at the Albert, really.
Well, that's the thing, is like, that song obviously was written. It's amazing when you write something for a certain size of audience and then all of a sudden it becomes something that goes on way, way beyond that.
The same could be said for in some sense for the song. There's a song on that same record, Haile Selassie Up Your Ass whatever. That song was never meant to be, the genesis of that song was getting in a fight, an actual fight with a local band, this homophobic band that was playing a Bad Brains song that, you know, Don't Blow No Bubbles, as, you know, as an homage to homophobia.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, because I was such a big Bad Brains fan, Eye Against Eye was another record that was transformative in my musical evolution. And I was so disappointed when Quickness came out and that song was on there and I realized what it was about and heard the stories from Dave Dichter later in the early 90s, because they came through and stayed at our house and played in Winnipeg, and hearing the stories about how Bad Brains treated them, you know, it was so disappointing. So that song was sort of written for, again, an audience in Winnipeg, and it blew up into something we probably didn't want it to be. We sing different lyrics to it now.
Yeah.
Some different lyrics, just to put it in proper context. But yeah, that was all songs. Everything we wrote back then was just meant to be played at the Albert. We didn't, we had no ambition beyond that. We had no idea anybody besides the 10 people that would come see us at the Albert, which included 9 skinheads, would ever fucking hear it.
But there, you know, it's funny because there are some universals that you're singing to in those songs, even, like, and I know, you know, obviously the message, you know, you wish you could say it differently. Believe I have a whole record of messages I wish I could say differently now, myself, nowhere near as eloquently as you did. But it's amazing, like, because, you know, you think about that and then you think about, like, yeah, there's hypocritical, like, the skinheads that liked ska music, but they were kind of like sketchy white power dudes. In every scene, you know, except Toronto, we didn't really have a lot of that because the BFGs really dealt with a lot of the skinheads. And so it wasn't really an issue except for a couple shows ever in Toronto, as far as I can remember, at least. But with the songs becoming popular, I guess, when did you first play with NOFX?
Would that have been 92?
Okay.
Or 91.
Had you
Samson
toured?
Was in the band. John, we had done like, no, we had played like out to Regina.
Okay.
Maybe played Brandon or something like that. But we'd never gone on a full tour. That wasn't even something we thought could ever. Well, no, we probably thought that could happen. That was the age of book your own fucking life and stuff. So, but yeah, we played with them in 92. And then I think after he expressed interest in us, we booked a tour out to San Francisco, didn't even contact him when we went out there, just went there and came home. But that was cool. That was our first show ever in the States, was with Jawbreaker.
Wow.
In Rapid City. Yeah.
That's awesome.
It was it was a crazy night.
Did you you guys just decided that was your first foray across the border too?
First foray across the border. Borders were very different then.
Yeah.
You just drove to some fucking small town in southern Manitoba at 9 p.m. as the guy's getting off his shift and just basically let you through on a dirt road. And into the States you went. But we didn't really, it was so poorly booked. We did it ourselves. We got paid, I think, one bottle of wine on the whole trip or something. I don't know.
Were you with another band or by yourselves?
No, it was just us. Yeah, we had a cassette to show people, or that was about it.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Complete your staining project with Pittsburgh Paints and Stains, now at Menards. Stain in one coat with Ultra Advanced Semi-Transparent Stain. It's a stain and sealant in one that can be applied to damp wood and on hot, sunny days, allowing you to clean and stain your deck in one day. Save big money on Pittsburgh Paints and Stains and head into Menards to get your staining project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
So what were those shows like? Obviously, the first show with Jawbreaker was probably pretty good around that time. I imagine Jawbreaker had a fan base.
Yeah, it was small DIY Rapid City, South Dakota, but Rapid City at the time was kind of like a minor mecca outside of Berkeley. Rapid City, you know, was the place to go if you were a touring punk band, which is very strange now because no one speaks of Rapid City in that way.
Was
anymore,
Skeen
but,
Records from there or something?
Skeen Records?
Well, I remember that label put the Green Day's first 7-inch and the Fuel split with Flag Camp, I think.
Oh, yeah? That maybe?
I remember they had a Berkeley, it was like a Berkeley, Minnesota connection between the two, but maybe it was South Dakota.
Oh, Minnesota. Okay, Minnesota. That might have been, probably Mankato or something.
Okay, maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
But no, Rapid City just had, it was known for putting on, for bands coming through, it was somewhere to go, you know, between in Washington and Minneapolis, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it was cool. It was really very, very, very memorable show with Jawbreaker. They were awesome. I remember the singer came up as we finished and said, "Keep playing. We never get to play with good bands." And we were blown away because we were huge Jawbreaker fans. I'm not sure if he actually meant it or if he needed some time to go smoke a doobie or something. But it definitely stayed with us.
I was going to say, Blake's very genuine in my experience, too. So I would like to think that he was being genuine in that, not just smoking weed. If it was me, it might be a weed excuse, though, I got to say, because it's something on my mind a lot these days. So I guess you go out to San Francisco. Did you play with any other bands out on the way? Anyone else that stood out to you? Or was it just kind of like the slog?
No, we played with... Not Scared Straight. Face Down. Do you remember a band from Cincinnati or somewhere in Ohio? What are they called? Face Value.
Face Value. Tony Erba's band.
Yeah, it was like a straight edge hardcore band.
Yes, Tony Erba from the H100s, the bass player of the H100s, and he played bass in Nine Shocks Terror, but he used to be the lead singer of that band.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And like he's a real, real hyperactive,
yeah,
talkative guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That was funny. We played in a bar, maybe Eugene, Oregon. It was, I don't know where it was. And, I think it might've been called Stinkies or something. And, there was nobody there except some locals who were not interested. And then I remember him when we played, he was super interested, like right into it and going crazy and was a really nice guy. But they were kind of there. I mean, we didn't know what to think of straight edge hardcore back then. We thought it was very strange.
Yeah. I don't think he was straight edge much longer after that band. he's been on the show too. He's the H100s. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they are
no
they are one of the most amazing American rock and roll bands ever. Like, just...
Oh, really?
Oh, their shows are some of the most terrifying experiences that can be... Oh, legendary, legendary band. I think you should check them out.
I will, definitely. It's interesting. That's that is not what I would have expected that band to go on to.
No, and I was going to also say he's very a very interesting guy, because like the whole time he's into that youth crew stuff, he's also super into like international hardcore, and so the H100s are completely informed by like Japanese hardcore and like Italian super raw hardcore. So it's like blazing, like just it's awesome. I don't want to.
Is it sort of like, you know, Devin Morf's stuff? Like what's his band? I blanked on it. But he does his band.
Oh, Under Pressure.
Japanese hardcore. Which one?
Under Pressure.
No, I don't think it is. It like, Under Pressure. Winnipeg,
Winnipeg band. Japanese hardcore influence. I know the band.
Oh yeah. No, I'm talking about. You remember Devin Morf used to write for MRR? He was in All You Can Eat.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He was also in What Happens Next.
I think. What Happens Next? That's it.
Yeah, it's
kind of like that.
More blown out and blazing than that, even. And it's like,
oh, cool.
Yeah, like the lyrics are insane. I think it's, I don't know. I think it's something that you will find fairly interesting. But it is awesome that Propagandhi and Face Value played on in like 1992 together. That is so wicked.
I wonder if he remembers it.
I don't know. I've got next time he's supposed to come back on the show because we tapped out at an hour and a half last or 2 hours last time, and then so he's like he's going to come back on the show. So I'll definitely, believe me, that is going to be something that comes up. So you get out to San Francisco, and did you like just reach out to Mike when you get out there, or
no? We didn't at all.
Okay.
Which is, you know, just another, we just didn't, we've never done anything. We've never done anything smart. We've never done anything that would, you know, any networking kind of stuff.
Yeah.
We've always been very poor at that. And in a way, I think it ended up serving us well, but, it wasn't very smart at the time.
Was that the goal?
No, he kept bugging us. He just kept phoning us, and we were like, geez, this guy is serious. So, and I would tell him, I'd say, you know, I got a 4-track recorder here. We can make a 7-inch. And he's like, no, that's not how I want to do this label. We thought he was crazy. And he offered us, he said he'd pay for 6 days down at West Beach Recorders. If we could, I think if we would make our way down there, he would pay for that. And we thought, this is fucking crazy. Cause I was a big fan of the Suffer record. At that point, I thought the NOFX Rib record was really cool, and those were both done at West Beach. So we just couldn't believe somebody was gonna do this for us. So
what did he have out by this point? Was it like just the Longest Line and Lagwagon?
I think so. Yeah, I think that was it. That was it. I actually liked that Longest Line record a lot too.
Yeah.
At the time. So it was all very exciting. But it didn't. I didn't really think it was gonna go anywhere.
I just
thought this guy's wasting his money.
So you go out. I guess had you done any other tours since then, or did you just go out again for the second time?
Yeah, we no other tours. Just played in Winnipeg, same old shit, and got on a plane. I think we got on a plane and went down to LA and. You know, with my fucking Crate solid state amp in a hockey bag, and off we went to West Beach.
You recorded that with Crate? The How to Clean Everything's recorded with the Crate?
Yeah, they laughed at me when I showed up with it.
Man, that's, and, we recorded our first stuff with the Crate amp too.
See, I plugged the I still have the amp, and I plugged in it the other day, and it sounds decent. And they laughed at me when I showed up with it. And then they plugged it into. Somebody's marketable. We can do that.
That's awesome. Holy Jesus. Crate.
I had no idea. I had no idea there was a difference between I didn't know what a tube amp was or a solid state amp. I didn't know anything. We knew nothing about anything.
Yeah, I think we were in the same position. And
that's reflected, I think, in some of the early records.
Well, I think that record is a Stone Cold classic, and I can remember the moment I bought it and everything like that. But this is not the Damien Abraham podcast. So, when you guys finished it, what did you kind of think this was going? What was going to happen to it? Like, were you guys just like, well, that's it?
Yeah. Well, I knew it wasn't it because halfway through the recording, Mike walked into the room with a contract saying, hey, you guys signed this for the next record. And we were just like, next record? What the fuck's this guy talking about? We're not even done this one. But I guess at that point he thought, okay, this is sounding how I want it to sound or whatever.
Yeah.
He thought there was some potential. We were just, and I think we just felt, honestly, we felt totally put on the spot, but we just didn't want to be rude and not sign the guy's paper who had just flown us down here to make these songs. We just signed this thing without even reading it, really, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out okay.
But like, so by this point, was he producing it and Ryan Green? Was that who produced the first one?
No, it was Donnell Cameron.
Okay.
He did all the classic West Beach stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Mike was there and was there pretty much the whole time. And we didn't know what a producer was. We didn't know what producing was. We didn't know anything about that. So he would come in and tell me, you know, suggest something. And I would look at him like, what the fuck are you doing in here? And then, you know, but he had a couple suggestions that I think were helpful. And the rest, I think we just ignored thinking,
yeah.
Why is he here? yeah.
What was like?
We truly had no idea.
What was your relationship like? You mentioned you liked the Rib record. What did you think of NOFX prior to this as a band?
Well, I thought the stuff before Ribbed was, I thought it was not very good.
You're not a Mystic 7-inch fan then?
No, I did not like that at all. I didn't like S&M Airlines. I didn't like Liberal Animation. I thought it was all missing the mark, but the Rib record, I thought it was really good. It was kind of doing what when I first heard Bad Religion Suffer, I thought this is Motorhead and the Ramones perfectly mixed, and NOFX just added this, you know, that RKL-ish influence was a little more metallic, and I thought that was great. And you know, all the novelty stuff on there was, at the time, I thought, haha, that's funny. Yeah, liked it. I thought Ribbed, I think Ribbed is their best record. I think it's the best record they ever made.
I think because of the time I got into it, I'm gonna have to say Punk and Drublick, but I will go Ribbed number two for me.
Cool.
But that's just me. But that's what I told you, I was going to find a way to put myself into this as much as possible. Did that record immediately get a big response, or was it like something, and how aware were you of even a response that it was getting when it came out?
Like the How to Clean record?
Yeah.
Not really. We expected nothing, and we didn't really know what was going on. We actually weren't that interested. At the time, that scene that was taking off, the Fat Records and Epitaph scene, wasn't interesting us besides, you know, those records I had mentioned.
Yeah.
We were becoming more interested in the scene that was kind of evolving around, not musically, but, you know, idea-wise, that was revolving around bands like Born Against and Drop Dead. That seemed more. That seemed to have more. It was more value-driven than it was just, you know, fucking schlocky, goofy skate punk kind of stuff. Which I mean, clearly we were in that genre once that record came out. For better or for worse, but we didn't really, we weren't from California. We didn't have any of those sensibilities. We were far more interested in what was going on in the basements and the VFW halls and the, you know, the radical bookstores in America than we were in what was happening with the snowboard video scene that was, you know, putting all these comps together with all these skate rock bands. We had no interest in that. So we didn't know about it, and we did not capitalize from that. Like we went on tours after that record came out, you know, 2 months playing in basements, mm-hmm. where all those other bands were already playing, you know, they were well established and making lots of money, but and selling shirts and merch hand over fist. And we were just more interested in the basement scene. We thought there was something more to it than just doing the fucking rock and roll shtick.
When you talk about bands like, you know, Born Against and stuff, and I think, you know, a Canadian counterpoint to me of that is almost like I Spy. And was that, when did that I Spy split? Was that just after that too?
That was 94.
Oh, 94 that came out. Oh, way later.
I think, wasn't it? Well, it was, yeah. Well, I mean, I became aware of them in probably 92 or 93.
Okay.
And I lived with Todd, who was the singer for I Spy during those years. So,
yeah.
And I mean, I worshiped that band too. For all the same reasons I've described for liking MDC or whatever, you know, just the sense of urgency. Yeah, it was just a very exciting band to see live. And we fed off each other. We tried to help each other, you know, support each other's bands. And we were all more interested in that kind of underground DIY scene than we were in the exploding mainstream punk scene.
Yeah, they were, they're a band that I think is just kind of criminally underrated as far as like a hardcore band goes. Like the passion, just like, especially on that split with you guys, like the, just bleeds out so much from the vocals.
Yeah.
And so.
Did you ever see them live?
Never. No, I don't think they ever, I don't know if they ever made it to Toronto.
Probably not out east, I guess.
Yeah.
They made it to Europe. They played Europe a couple times, which is crazy. And they did some American shows, mostly Midwest and West Coast, I think. But yeah, they were just an unpredictable explosion live.
Well, actually, this might be where there's a rumor that you came to Toronto roadieing for some band about a year before you guys played those shows in Southern Ontario. Did you roadie for them out here or something by any chance?
No.
There's like an urban legend that you were like, people saw you at shows in Toronto at some Winnipeg band that you were roadieing for show in Toronto at the Elma Combo. This is like
well,
90s folklore coming back to be proved untrue.
Unless somebody saw me and Jord, we were at a Failsafe show in 1986 in Toronto.
Nope, this would have been way later than that.
Not that one, eh?
No, this was just apparently a liar trying to get scene cred back then.
I don't remember that.
Well, I'll put your mind at ease, this person I have not seen at a show since the year 1999. So I don't know where their lies got them, but apparently not still in punk. I guess like you guys did that basement tour. Where was that basement tour after the record came out?
Oh fuck!
Like Midwest, I guess.
Midwest, we went out to like I think North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, kind of went everywhere. Alabama, Birmingham, yeah. Did we go to Florida? No, but maybe Birmingham was as far south as we got.
So like pretty much a full U.S. tour.
Kind sort of in this weird kind of loop that I think I used to work at CAA.
Yeah.
And I made the maps there for tours. So I think what I did was try to make a loop that made sense with all the most, the burgeoning punk, DIY punk scenes in America. Yeah, like we did a lot of, St. Louis at the time was also kind of a place you had to go. There was, you know, the Meat Sisters were from there, and that was kind of an exciting scene. Chicago, Los Crudos.
Yeah.
It was, yeah, all that kind of stuff. So we tried to, Madison was another one of these towns. I think, was Damn It All from there? I think Damn It All was from somewhere in Wisconsin. Wisconsin had, you know, it's weird. It's weird to think of all the little hotbeds of, you know, when you had scene reports in MRR coming from these small towns or places that don't really seem to have scenes now. It's funny to look back and see what was an exciting place to go.
It seemed like every place that had a university had some sort of punk scene.
Yeah, that's probably it.
But yeah, like you're right. There's you just don't see it in the same sort of way anymore.
Yeah.
What was the aversion though to touring Canada at this point?
I don't know if we had one. We didn't know how to make things happen.
And it's long.
We've never
drives.
Had. Probably the long drive. I don't know what the fuck we were thinking, you know? I don't know what we never knew what we were doing. We just made stuff up as we went along, you know, a tour we get booked, we'd be like, ah, fuck, cancel it. Let's do something. You know, it was weird. You know, we didn't take things seriously. And we didn't put a priority on touring. Never have. I mean, the past 7 years is the most we've ever toured, which is crazy because we have our lives so much more complicated now. But that's, you know, we were just so fucking disorganized and perhaps disinterested in the kind of real work it takes to make a band work back then. We were just very lucky. A lot of lucky bounces for us, as they say.
After How to Clean Everything comes out, did you guys kind of just keep touring regularly after that at this point, like just doing basement tours, or was it?
Not even regularly, no. And I think now that we're talking about it, I think that was part of what worked for our band. It started to turn into this pre-internet. You know, it became this thing like, who is this band where they never play shows. They won't come to America. They've been banned from America.
Yeah. That's what I always heard.
Snowball all these ideas. Yeah. All these ideas about why we didn't tour, why we wouldn't play certain cities. It was just pure fucking negligence. You know, we were just total dingbats, but people would make up these narratives about they're not coming here because, something happened in the scene or they won't play this because of this political decision that was made by the, you know, city hall. It's just crazy shit or they're not allowed to leave Winnipeg.
Yeah.
Just fucking weirdness. They worked for us. It created this mystique for a while, you know, the same mystique that kind of propelled Venom back in the early 80s for a few years.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I may compare ourselves to Venom for a second, for no reason.
I was going to say the same mystique that propelled us in the early years too. So believe me, I was going to compare myself to you guys. Yeah. So there you go. and so there is that kind of mystique about you guys and sort of these like crazy, you know, urban legends and stories that begin kind of circulating about propaganda and what this band is and what these people are like. And everything like that. So what is kind of like your mindset going into recording the next record at this point? Because you guys did some splits or the FYP split. Was that after that or before that?
That FYP split was a year after How to Clean Everything.
Okay.
As far as I remember.
Okay.
And I think that and the next record were sort of reactions to the genre we suddenly found ourselves in that we didn't, you know, from the get-go, we felt like, I don't know if we're really part of this. This snowboard shit and surfing and skateboard. I don't know. Like people were coming up to us at these shows in California, giving us boxes of skater clothes, you know, as if we're going to fucking wear it. What are you doing, man? Look at us. Fucking look at us. And we're dressed by our mothers still. And so I think that the 10-inch and Less Talk More Rock certainly were our most conscious reactions to how we were being perceived in the world. You know, the Less Talk More Rock is the record probably the only record we have where we had some intent on how we wanted the record to end up and be perceived. because we suddenly realized we had this platform, where we have this genre of people that are, you know, we played a few of the shows that those bands in California, from California, play. We saw that the demographic was largely white male meatheads.
Yeah, affluent meatheads.
And yeah, and we thought, well, we have to do something responsible with our next record and make sure that in no uncertain terms our view of the world, which is ironclad in your early 20s,
mm-hmm.
is portrayed correctly on the record. And I thought we did a great job of that.
I mean,
there's a lot of cringeworthy things about that, but in its essence, I think that if anybody asked me what I think about, you know, the world or whatever, just say, well, fuck, go listen to that record. Now that tells you exactly what I think about the world, you know, and I don't really need to ever make another record again. but we keep doing it, but that one still sums it all up for me. And the reaction to that record was directly, or was entirely predictable, in that it just flopped.
Did it flop, really?
Well, in relation to where that scene was going and how the first record had done.
Wow, really? Because that to me was the record, maybe it's just, once again, because of my time, but like that record was the record where it's like that record came out and it like changed everything. Like nothing was the same after that. Like you were either on one side or another in punk rock after that record came out.
That's cool. I like that. I like that interpretation of it.
Well, it was, and you had to pick a side, you know, like there's no other option in that record. Like otherwise you felt bad the whole way listening to it, because like there's every song is about something, you know? And it was like, especially in a genre where like you're normally listening, for me, it was always like, you're waiting for that one song that's about something to come on, you know, like that. There's always like that one song on the strung out record that's ambiguously political enough where you're like, well, this is kind of speaking to something. And so those were always the songs that I would get behind, but then there's a whole record of, and then the liner notes and, you know, organizations and all this stuff that I could like, you know, follow up on it with. It's like, oh, like it's a record that changed everything. And so I'm just shocked to hear that it wasn't that way everywhere.
Well, it was, I mean, maybe it was for, I think for that demographic, it was like people who would like the first record and were like, dude, they have a new one. Let's look at it. And they looked at the record. It says gay positive on the front. It says gay positive. That was like immediately 50% of the people immediately 50% of the people who were interested in the first one would not touch that. When I was 15, would I have brought home a record that said gay positive on the front? Not, no fucking way. Not in Portage La Prairie. I would not have. Wouldn't have touched it with a 10-foot pole. And I mean, it also said pro-feminist, and this, you know, everything on there was geared to draw a line in the sand. And the response was commensurate to that. And I think it showed, you know, I mean, it's predictable that demographic would not necessarily take kindly to that kind of broadside of their worldview. And, you know, it wasn't a carbon copy sonically at the first record either. You know, I decided to sing differently. I was mortified by the vocals on the first record, even back then, you know. They're so ridiculous, so cartoonish. And the ones on Let's Talk More Rock aren't that much better, but at least I wasn't singing in a fucking British accent or whatever was happening on the first record.
I don't hear a British accent. I love the vocals on the first one, but hey, this is your show.
So, yeah, it just was. But I mean, every record we've ever put out has been dismissed offhand at first. You know, everybody who liked the one before it says, oh, this one sucks. And then 6 months later, people are like, no, this is the best one. And then it happens up, including the last record, Failed States, we put out. People were like, oh, this isn't as good as the last one. And then 6 months later, this is my favorite one.
Yeah.
You know, you know how that goes. Nobody's ever you know.
Well, normally I'm just used to this isn't as good as the last one, and that's where they normally check out, and we have to get a new fan to replace that person. But in my experience, thus far, do you tour out for that record immediately, but you do tour out for that one.
We do. I think we only got one full European, well, full for us, full like 3 weeks in Europe before me and Samson started talking about, you know, changing stuff up, you know, getting a different bass player. So maybe there was only the one. Yeah. No, well, I guess, well, once Kowalski got in the band, we kept playing some shows sporadically, you know, based on those two records. We've never really been a band that tours for the record. We always, I guess we do, but we weren't really thinking that way.
Yeah.
Of promoting a record. We were just playing, well, these are the songs we have and they're on those two records and that's what we're going to play live. Yeah.
Because when did you do that East Coast Canadian tour? Was that I guess a year later, maybe?
Where did it go to?
You guys came. I remember you played like every city in Southern Ontario two nights in a row.
Oh God, yes, that tour.
And that I think that's Todd's one of his first tours, right? That's one of Todd's first tours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember that. That was a rough one. Holy fuck.
Well, there are some amazing things I want to ask you about from that tour. And I know I'm keeping you up really late and you and me both have to get up early with kids. So I promise we'll cut it early and I got to do a second episode with you in the future because I could go on
for sure,
all night with these questions.
No, for sure. This is, I like it because you're triggering things I haven't thought about in a long time.
Well, that's what I'm hoping to do. That's what my goal with this thing too. Well, speaking of things you haven't thought about in a long time, that Southern Ontario tour, it's a massive tour for me and all my peers and a lot of people in Southern Ontario. But did you guys tour the whole way out, I guess, from Winnipeg?
We must have. I don't know. Yeah, we did. Yeah, because we played Thunder Bay. Oh, yeah, we played Thunder Bay, Sault Ste. Marie. Yeah, we played all that way out there. North Bay, maybe.
What were those shows like then?
Well attended.
Yeah, because I can't say a little bit of a scene.
Yeah, the guy who tours with us now, Dave Hugel, he put on the shows in Sault Ste. Marie at the time.
Oh,
and I don't know if he put on our show, but yeah. But I mean, they're well attended, but I can't say we were any good. That's for sure. That was we have. If you ask Kowalski about that tour. Oh boy, yeah. It's just our most dismal memory of playing live. Some of those, I think playing. Where was that fucking place? It's just east of Toronto.
Oshawa.
Not Ajax.
Oshawa.
Oshawa.
Yeah, you guys played with the pre-Closet Monster band. I can't remember what they're called now. Damn it. What were they called? Anyway, the pre-Closet Monster band opened for the
one. I remember that too. He put on the show, that guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For us.
London.
But, yeah, London. But we were, I mean, if you see a YouTube video of that Oshawa show these days, it's just so fucking dismal and boring. And, oh, God, just.
Well, I don't think
it's the worst.
That's not your guys' fault. Because I was at that show and I thought it was fantastic. But I
really?
Oh, absolutely. And also, that was the day that I bought the Noam Chomsky. A manufacturing consent book that completely changed everything for me. So,
oh yeah,
it's a big day for me, that show. I also bought the gay positive pro feminist shirt, with the anarchy symbol on my chest. I got all so many vivid memories coming back. It's flooding too many feelings right now, Chris, too many feelings. But no, it was but also just cause that time shows sucked for crowd reactions. Like people were just staring at you guys. I remember, I wasn't trying to kick it off or set it off in any way either, but like it was, everyone's just like in awe and I really describe it as being in awe. Everyone's just like staring at you guys.
Well, I like that interpretation better than ours, which is like, we would, whatever momentum we possibly had back in those days, we would, you know, play a song, here's a song. And 30 seconds later, okay, now a 5-minute speech about this next song, you know, and it's just, if you watch, obviously, if anybody watches themselves fucking pontificating to a crowd back in, you know, 20 years ago, you are going to want to blow your head off
exactly
to see that again. It's so brutal. But I like your interpretation better.
Well, I was going to say Martin from Crudos is one of the few people that I've always thought just, you know, his speeches just always captivate and hold the attention. But I wonder, I bet you he's the same way. He goes back and watches the old ones and he's like, here I go again.
Crudos, they were the best.
They're an amazing band.
They were amazing. Definitely the best.
I guess on another show, speaking of the best bands and bands that would go on to become other bands, another show on that tour that you played was London, Ontario. I think you played Call the Office. And two bands opened for you. One is Shoulder, the pre-Constantine's band. The other one.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. And you guys like Shoulder. You said so on stage. I have a live bootleg tape to verify this. But one band that you guys did not get along with that night, Left 4 Dead. Do you remember that?
Really?
Yeah, Left 4 Dead. Left 4 Dead, because I think what you're saying is, you know, people began to associate you guys with a scene that nothing about you other than the first record and some of the songs on that first record spoke to.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. I know what you're talking. Yeah, I remember that show.
Yeah.
And Kowalski said something about, he said, all the posers leave. Oh, no one left. I guess there's no posers here.
Yeah.
Or something like
that. Yeah, yeah. And then he goes, and then you go, where was that band from? And they start yelling, Hamilton, Hamilton. And you're like, whatever. They were terrible. And then I think George or someone says, Shoulder was good, though. That starts.
That's weird, because I think I remember liking Left 4 Dead before we even got there.
Yeah, I'm sure, because it's chokehold dudes and
yeah,
you know, and I think it's funny because I had Chris on this podcast, and the reason I bring this up is because Chris Callahan, who's now, you know, Cursed, Burning Love, and everything, was the singer in Left 4 Dead, and
yeah,
it's amazing. And he was talking, he's like, yeah, I really, you know, look back on that and look foolish, because it's like the one, like all the shots they were taking at you guys was because they didn't get it. And now it's like, you know, all the dust clears and it's like, what's the one band that kind of holds true? It's like Propaganda, you know? And he kind of like admitted that on this podcast.
Oh, weird. I didn't even know. I can't even, my memory's so fucking shot by this.
Well, mine's just life, so nerdy.
Yeah. I didn't even remember them taking shots at us.
Yeah, it was.
I thought they were just taking shots at the crowd or something. But now I'm really mad.
Beef ain't over. Well, they're back together.
Yeah, let's start that shit up again.
Let's start it over.
Oh, good.
But
the scene needs a new beef.
Well, I think I don't know. Having been in several failed beefs over the years, it's never as fun as it looks like in the rap documentary.
Yeah, no, it always gets very tired very quickly. I've been in a few myself. I get very tired.
I know, and I don't want to get into, like, not beefs, but I want to get into all this other stuff in the future. But I guess kind of to wrap up on the two Toronto shows that you guys played, or three. No, you guys did two in downtown Toronto. I thought it was kind of cool because you did it one night with like kind of the pop punky promoters in town, like with all the bands that were kind of like, you know, definitely of the more Epiphat influence. But then you did another night with like Grade and Jersey, who at the time were like a very much a DIY band. And I think Blake might've played too, who are like a DIY kind of band from Toronto. Was that kind of a conscious effort that you guys did to resist playing with the big, you know, Epiphat type promoters in every city?
Were those two shows different promoters?
Yeah, I think so. I think one was by you and Exile, and I think one was by Raw Energy, the people that did the label in town.
Okay, because I remember the Grade show for sure, because it was a Friends of the Lubicon benefit.
Yeah.
That's the only one. I don't remember the other one at all. Were they both at the Alma Combo? Or?
Well, they're both at the Alma Combo. One was downstairs. The Grade show was downstairs. I was at that show. Unfortunately, the show upstairs, it was the last night I drank before I went straight edge for 10 years, so I didn't make it to the next show. But I broke my toe that night, too.
Well, I wasn't drinking that year, and I don't even remember that show. I remember the Grade show.
That was the other thing. There was all these rumors that you guys were super straight edge, that they were going to be checking if people were in leather shoes when they came into the club that night.
No, I think I was the only guy who wasn't drinking those couple of years.
Okay.
But I definitely wasn't identifying as straight edge.
Well, Chris, I don't think we're nearly done at all by any stretch of the imagination. But I think this is a good place to end because I want to go into tons of other stuff. And this seems like a reasonable place to end for two people that have to get up early tomorrow with kids.
Yeah, let's do it.
But I want to thank you so much for being on the show, man. This has been amazing to get to do this. And I cannot wait to do part two.
Right on, Damon. I really appreciate it. Yeah, we'll do the 1998 and on next time.
Exactly.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.